like that. All right, yes, on this show we try to do constructive dialogue, ladies and gentlemen, and no, we're not kidding, all right? We're telling the truth. So when I came across something recently, I thought, oh, absolutely, I want to talk more about this. So let's welcome to our program Caroline Mell, who is with the Constructive Dialogue Institute. And Caroline, first off, good morning, and thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
You're very welcome. Again, I came across this recently, and I kind of reached out to you almost on a whim, thinking, oh, this is, because this, again, we try to do this on our program, but yet when we look around in media and we look around in, I guess, call it public discourse, doesn't seem all that constructive very often. So I thought, let's tackle this one.
No,
so.
And I'm hoping we have other people listening in this morning, Caroline, because I'm really hoping. I try to have these constructive dialogues, and these stupid idiots aren't listening to me. I'm trying to explain to them the way they should be thinking, and Caroline, they're just not getting it. So can you help them this morning understand what it is I'm trying to get them to believe in? Is that possible that you can help these people out, because these morons are just they're very problematic.
Caroline, please tell me you're laughing. Huh? You are laughing, right?
What?
Yeah, I'd say that you're exactly hitting all the points of constructive dialogue right there. So you've got it already.
There it goes. Okay, Caroline, I'm really sorry, but no, that was a setup. All right. First off, let's start with some background, if we could. Tell us about yourself. Like, what is your background and so on? And then it's called the Constructive Dialogue Institute, I guess CDI. Tell us about you, and then tell us about your group. What do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the co-founder and executive director of the Constructive Dialogue Institute, or CDI, and I'm originally from New York. I grew up in a pretty traditional Jewish community. I'm the granddaughter of three Holocaust survivors, and my fourth grandparent was a refugee from Austria who was able to escape to the United States in 1939. And I share this because their stories of persecution, oppression, the atrocities that they experienced really shaped my worldview growing up. And especially in my 20s, I became very curious about how a society could get to the point of committing such atrocities against their fellow citizens. And so I started to dig into the research around that. And what I quickly discovered is that there's actually a clear body of evidence that shows that there's a pretty consistent path that people in societies can go down that begins with having contempt for others, then shifts to demonization of others, and then ultimately shifts to violence. Because once you feel as though someone else, another group, is so bad, so immoral, so beyond what you consider to be even fully human, it actually starts to feel like a moral imperative that you're supposed to commit violence against this group. And so this whole psychological kind of process became really interesting to me. It was something that I was interested in studying more, and it's what led me originally to become interested in, the underlying psychology of intergroup dynamics. Separately, on a more positive note, I had always just loved psychology. So again, in my early 20s, I discovered another field of research within psychology called positive psychology, which is really looking at the more positive aspect of human nature, essentially recognizing that most of psychology research had been focused on diagnosing and treating pathology, like what's wrong with people, rather than thinking about, well, how could we apply the same scientific method to discovering what helps people flourish? That's what the field of positive psychology is all about. And the more I learned about positive psychology, the more I felt like, oh, wow, this was completely revolutionizing the way I saw the world, the way I engage with people, helping me make better decisions, improving my well-being. So I also started to feel really strongly that there was something here that I was really interested in. I had this kind of strong desire to bring these ideas into the world to help, lift up individuals, organizations, and society. And by chance, I was actually living in the UK back in 2015, 2016, when the Brexit vote happened. And I remember waking up, I wasn't particularly interested in British politics at the time, but I remember waking up the morning after the Brexit vote, and everyone around me was in a state of shock. Everyone was totally shocked by the outcome, and everyone felt like, oh, I don't know anyone who voted for Brexit. And so it made it very clear to me that I was living in this kind of echo chamber while I was over there, and that something strange is going on in our society, that there's this deep divide and people had really no understanding of how people could have voted a different way. I then moved back to the U.S. a couple of months later, right in time for the 2016 election. And I was living back in New York, where I'm from originally. And again, it was the same kind of experience, where in New York, I was living in Manhattan, and it felt like most people I knew were shocked by the outcome of the 2016 election. And so these combined experiences really highlighted to me that our society had reached this point where we had completely lost our ability to communicate across differences. We no longer understood each other. It was as if we were speaking completely different languages. And so I became really interested in solving that problem, and in particular in using psychology to try to address that problem. How can we think about what we know about how human nature operates, how our minds are wired, what leads us to these deep divisions, and then what does the psychology research tell us about how we can actually navigate these differences more effectively? So shortly after the election, I was already working with the psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who's one of the leading experts in the field of moral and political psychology. So he has been studying for years, you know, what leads people to be so deeply divided across political differences. Now, how is it possible that two people can look at the same set of facts and reach wildly different conclusions? And so we decided to really address this issue by co-founding a nonprofit called the Constructive Dialogue Institute. And we're a nonpartisan nonprofit, and we focus on working with colleges and universities across the country to help them create campus cultures that support dialogue across kinds of difference.
Now, you mentioned Dr. Haidt, and when I first, you know, came across your information recently, I thought, okay, I've heard that name before, because he wrote, I guess, a pretty famous piece about kids and smartphones, like kids and smartphones, bad, 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 bad. I mean, that's the same gentleman, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And he's a co-founder of your group.
Exactly.
Okay, all right. First off, very quickly, now, that piece that I just mentioned from Dr. Haidt, describe briefly what that was. Because as I recall, I think he was on TV shows and he got a lot of publicity about that. What was the whole point of his piece there?
Yeah, so he recently published a book called The Anxious Generation. And essentially it was looking at, what is the role of social media and smartphones on teen mental health issues. And over the last, say, at least 5 years, there's been an epidemic, a crisis among teen mental health. There are rates of depression, suicidality that are really off the charts compared to what we've seen in the past. And so what John was doing was he was examining what are the causes that have led us to this point, and really tracing the evidence around how screen time, social media, have contributed to what we're seeing today around this mental health crisis, especially with young people.
All right. Now, let's mention your website, which is constructivedialogue.org, all one word, constructivedialogue.org. And Caroline, I was obviously looking at the website and so on. We'll talk about the work that you folks do, but is it all colleges and universities? I mean, is that sort of the main emphasis, or do you kind of go out further than that?
We have done some work with some other audiences. Like, we've done work with the public and private sectors, but the vast majority of our work is with higher ed, and that's really our focus.
Caroline, I'm just curious, do you have any feel, I don't know if there's data available, but on how the pandemic maybe affected, in particular, young people as they're coming through school, maybe their ability to communicate along with the social media stuff, but I wonder how much of the struggles there to again just be able to talk reasonably with people, even if they agree with you, but especially if they disagree with you, just comes from what I think was some of the harm with the reaction to the pandemic, do you think that is playing a role in some of these communication issues, especially with our young people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say that it's definitely a factor. In looking at the data, the issues that we've been seeing around discourse, polarization, especially in college campuses, began before the pandemic. It really started to reach a fever pitch around 2015, 2017. And so the challenges that we're experiencing began before the pandemic. So the pandemic definitely contributed to it because exactly as you're saying, it took young people during a critical developmental stage where they needed the opportunity to, you know, become socialized, to practice engaging in face-to-face conversations. And so many young people were, you know, isolated for such a long period of time. So it definitely exacerbated the problem. And interestingly, what we're hearing from our campus partners is now that the students who were kind of hit most by being in high school during the pandemic have graduated out, the incoming students are actually starting to seem a little bit different because they had more time to like socialize and practice these types of conversations before entering college. So we're still seeing the same broader pattern around polarization, but the pandemic definitely had an impact that exacerbated the trend.
All right, now, Caroline, your group works with colleges, universities. We have this little school close to us. Actually, it's kind of big, Penn State. You do anything with Penn State?
You know, we haven't done anything with Penn State yet, but we would love to. So hopefully there's some listeners out there today who can help make that happen.
Well, yeah, that would be great.
Well, we'll see if we can make a connection here. I guess, Caroline, let's go very simple and basic. When we say constructive dialogue, oh, that sounds really nice. What is that? I mean, what is your definition of constructive dialogue?
Yeah, so we define constructive dialogue as a form of conversation where people with different perspectives try to understand each other without giving up their own beliefs in order to live, learn, and work together. And what I really want to emphasize is that piece around without giving up their own beliefs. Because oftentimes when people hear about constructive dialogue, they might say, oh, well, this feels, you know, very squishy, or I don't want to just meet in the middle. And so the point of constructive dialogue is to say, well, you know, different people will have their commitments, they'll have the deep convictions. And this is not about changing your mind. It's not about, you know, giving up or watering down your beliefs. It's really about how do you make space for others? How do you actually approach conversations with a desire to learn, to listen, to understand, to find commonality, to move forward, as opposed to letting your differences really derail conversations, derail the opportunity for relationships and for forward motion.
So is this sort of, I don't know, good old-fashioned debate, which we don't seem to do anymore? I don't know. Maybe I have my rose-colored glasses on about the past, that in the past we had nice, robust debates. Maybe that never happened. I don't know. Caroline, first off, did that ever happen? Am I making that up? And is this just sort of a return to just good old-fashioned, what we used to call debate, not debate teams necessarily? Is that what this is, or does it go further than that?
Yeah, I think that you're right that things have changed, that discourse has become a lot more challenging in recent years, and it's not just, you know, your imagination. You know, when we look back, things always seem rosier than they were, but there is really a marked difference in what we're seeing around discourse today. And I think, you know, debate is interesting. Debate is kind of also a complex term in and of itself. I think that depends on how you're thinking about debate, but constructive dialogue, I'd say, is slightly different in that debate is often about winning, in the sense that you're trying to, you know, win the argument. And constructive dialogue is not about winning or losing. It's more about understanding and making progress together. But it is similar in the sense of, you know, having robust exchange of ideas, you know, healthy conversations, working through complex issues. That's what it's all about.
All right, so when you folks go to a college or a university and you're going to, I don't know, do something with them in this realm of constructive dialogue, I don't know, just maybe like a simple, what do you do? I mean, do you only talk to certain groups? Do you want to talk to everybody? Do you do certain things? I mean, if when you go to a college or a university, what exactly do you do with them?
So our approach is really focused on shifting the culture of the institution. So giving the stakeholders on the campus the skills and resources they need to really change the nature of how discourse feels on their campuses. And so to do that, we have this, you know, broad suite of tools that are geared towards college presidents, incoming students, basically all the stakeholders in between, to give each of the stakeholders the set of skills and resources that they need to collectively contribute to an environment where people feel as though they can engage in healthy conversations across kinds of difference. And so starting at the top with college presidents, we work with presidents and their leadership teams to help them develop strategic action plans around, you know, what are the key drivers of change on their particular campus, what could change look like. Also working with leaders to think about how they can model what constructive dialogue looks like on their campus, in terms of how they show up, how they're talking about these values, how they're navigating conflicts themselves. We offer a variety of trainings and workshops for administrators, faculty, and staff in how to facilitate difficult conversations in curricular and co-curricular settings, how to kind of de-escalate situations. And then we also offer an online learning program for students that's often used with all incoming students through things like orientation programming that is designed to equip students with a shared language, shared set of skills, and how to navigate difficult conversations. So that's kind of at a high level the way that we work with institutions, so really giving them the skills they need to do the work. But I'm happy to share a little bit more about, you know, what are we teaching? What does that actually look like?
Okay, this is Scott. I must be getting old, all right? That, Caroline, that all sounds great. That sounds like common sense. And so I guess my next question is, why is this so difficult for certain groups out there or certain areas out there to pick up? All right. Now, here, you know, around here, we have an occasional protest, like a lot of other colleges and universities across the country and so on. And there have been these national protests that have kind of popped out this year, like every month. And I see people, you know, chanting, yelling, raving, raging, holding up signs with the F word. And by the way, Caroline, expletives are a no-go for me. All right, whenever I see somebody using expletives, that tells me that person has nothing left to argue with. And so all they're going to do now is swear. So why is this so, what you just described a minute ago, why is this so difficult to do? It seems like total common sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'd say that there are a couple of factors that are kind of intersecting with one another that have gotten us to where we are today. So there are things that are operating both at the level of human psychology. There is the media and social media ecosystem that we're in, and then there's also our broader political climate as a society. And so at the individual psychological level, essentially part of what's happening is that human beings are actually wired for tribalism. You might, you know, be hearing that word a lot over the last couple of years, but the idea that we are acting as though we're in these opposing tribes, where we see the world, see issues in terms of us versus them, where, you know, my side is right, your side is wrong, and we must defeat the other side. The reason why that's happening is that we are kind of wired for tribalism because as human beings, we are the descendants of ancestors who were able to survive because they were effective in cooperating with their in-group in order to defeat the out-group. And so as a result, we have inherited this tendency to engage in this kind of us versus them tribalistic thinking. Now, the thing that's important about tribalism is that even though we have a tendency to behave in this tribalistic way, and there's actually a lot of research that you can create this type of tribalistic way of thinking about completely trivial and mundane things. For example, there's research that if randomly assign people to be like the blue shirt team, the red shirt team, you know, they will form these strong identities around those shirts, even though they're completely arbitrary, and you can get them to behave in certain ways that, you know, they'll preference, you know, their own group, they'll create disadvantages for another group, like all these kinds of crazy things can escalate very quickly because it's part of our DNA to behave this way. But at the same time, obviously, when you look around, it's not as though we behave this way all the time. So the thing about our tribalistic tendencies is that they're actually very sensitive to local conditions, meaning you can think about our tribalism almost like a volume knob, where it can be turned up or turned down. And the reason that it turns up is due to the conditions around us. So if we are in conditions where we are feeling as though we're being pitted against one another, different groups, different people, if we feel as though we are competing for scarce resources, these are the types of conditions that help create this tribalistic impulse. It's almost like you're flipping on a tribalism switch. And so our conditions around us have created this environment in recent years. Part of that is due to our media and social media environment. So we are living in a world where the headlines that we see in the news are often sensationalized, very extreme. Our social media feeds are optimized to trigger outrage. There's been a lot of research on this that when social media companies, the key metric that they care about is engagement, and engagement is driven by content that sparks outrage. That tends to be the most engaging content. And so as a result, you know, when you open up your social media feed, you're seeing the most extreme voices from your side and other side, and it hardens your views against the other side because you start to think that people who believe something different than you, or people that you consider to be part of the other tribe, they're so much more extreme than what they actually are, which actually relates to another psychological concept, which is known as the perception gap, where there is actually a gap between what we think people believe and what they actually believe. And what I mean by that is there's been a lot of research, again, on the fact that if you ask people, if you poll, let's say, Republicans and Democrats, you know, what do you think the average Republican or Democrat believes about various issues, let's say gun control, immigration? People tend to expect that the other side, on average, has a much, much more extreme view than they actually do in reality. And again, this is all the result of the fact that we have created these echo chambers where we tend to live and encounter people who have similar views and beliefs to us. And so it actually makes our views more hardened. And then the exposure that we have to people of opposing views also tends to be the loudest, most extreme voices. The last piece is that our political system is also exacerbating this, where politicians are seeing polarization as a way to actually drive, you know, elections, campaigns. I live in Washington, D.C., so I actually know that, you know, to an extent, obviously there's animosity, but a lot of these, you know, members of Congress, they're putting on a show. Like, they're much friendlier with one another in real life than what they pretend when they're, you know, on TV. And it's because it's part of this narrative that actually helps them, drive clicks, drive donations. One of the key drivers of voting behavior is actually one of the best predictors of how people vote is how much they dislike the other side rather than how much they like the candidate that they're voting for. And so all these factors together have created this environment that has created a hyperdrive situation around polarization, tribalism, and it makes it much more difficult for people to engage in reasoned conversations with one another because they see others as a caricature of who they really are.
All right, we're going to take a break here. Caroline, you got two hosts in the studio. We're both nodding our heads. Yes, everything you just said. Yes, absolutely. Let's take a break. Again, our guest is Caroline Mell from the Constructive Dialogue Institute. Really good stuff. Again, their website, constructivedialogue.org. Check it out. There's some pretty good stuff in there. We're going to take a break. We'll have a few more minutes with Caroline. You're listening to Let's Talk on 98.7 The Fox, and we'll come right back.
We don't just talk sports, we live it. Sports Radio 98.7 The Fox.
Have you checked out our new website, 98.7thefox.info? When you do, be sure to scroll to the bottom, enter your email address. Then sometime soon, you'll be a 98.7 The Fox insider with our newsletter feature, thoughts from some of our hosts that you won't get on our shows, messages from sponsors, and even special deals as an insider newsletter exclusive. We'll take good care of your email address, no sharing or selling. Hope you'll join us on 98.7thefox.info and enter your email address at the bottom. Be an insider, only from 98.7 The Fox.
Are you looking for the best pizza in town? Look no further than Brothers Pizza in downtown Bellefonte. Good, fast, and did I mention really good? Brothers Pizza also delivers to the immediate area, but you can also enjoy sit-down dining with convenient on-street parking. For fast, friendly delivery, call 355-5581 or stop by at 102 North Allegheny Street in downtown Bellefonte. Brothers Pizza, downtown Bellefonte.
Are you paying too much for your health insurance? Are your deductibles too high? Or are you completely uninsured? If you answered yes to any of these questions, Healthcare Help Desk can help you now, when people need help the most. Health insurance laws and rules have changed. If you have Obamacare, are uninsured, or your premiums are too high,
call Healthcare Help Desk. It's free. New healthcare plans are available, and you may qualify for dental coverage and lower copays and deductibles. Make the free call now. Top quality coverage at the lowest prices anywhere. You may be paying too much and not even know it. In these troubled times, healthcare is more important than ever. Don't let another day go by without health insurance. Policies are being offered with very low copays and deductibles. So if you're uninsured, underinsured, or paying too much, call Healthcare Help Desk.
800-930-2263. 800-930-2263. 800-930-2263.
It's Grange Fair season, and Clearwater Swimming Pool Company is bringing the hot deals to the fair. Stop by our booth and explore our full lineup of hot spring spas, built for comfort, performance, and year-round relaxation. During the Grange Fair only, save up to $1,000 on select models. Plus, get 50% off accessories like coverlifts, handrails, and ozones. Every tub includes a free cover and step, so you're soaking in serious value. Visit Clearwater at the Grange Fair and bring comfort and relaxation to your very own backyard.
Stay big and head to your local Toro dealer, Maxwell Equipment, for the sales event going on now. Stop in today and get up to $1,500 off select Z-Master mowers and Grandstand, Multi-Force, Stand-Ons, plus $500 off select attachments. Visit Maxwell Equipment on Shiloh Road for more details on promotions and financing offers. Toro, count on it.
It's Let's Talk here on a Wednesday morning.
All right, we got about 10 more minutes. Again, our guest is Caroline Mell from the Constructive Dialogue Institute. Again, their website, constructivedialogue.org. And yes, if anybody at Penn State's listening, why don't you drop these folks a line? And I'm not saying that Penn State has a problem. Caroline, actually, again, we look at the last, I don't know, year, year and a half, 2 years, at all of these, I don't know, college protests and I call it craziness and things going on. We haven't had nearly as much of that around here. Now, does your group do anything with Ivy League schools? Because, again, that's where I'm a bit mystified. Ivy League schools are supposed to be the best and brightest. They're so smart. And yet we keep hearing things about lack of free speech, anti-Semitism, some of these out-of-control protests at places like Columbia and Harvard and some other places. Do you do anything with the Ivy League? And I'm wondering why those folks are seemingly having a real problem when it comes to constructive dialogue. What do you think there?
Yeah, we do work with a number of Ivy League schools, and I think that's an interesting question, why it's happening more acutely in those types of institutions. I think part of it, we actually did an analysis last year. We published a research paper on this looking at what were the factors that contributed to protests happening on certain campuses. And interestingly, what we found is that campuses with the average SAT scores, the higher the average SAT scores, the more likely it was that you would have this kind of disruptive campus protest or an encampment on campus. So there is definitely some kind of relationship there. We also found things around location. So being in, you know, major cities, other things like that, depending on the local population, also contributed to the scale of these types of protests. So I think that on the one hand, there is probably something going on around these universities. On the other hand, these universities also tend to get a lot more media attention than others. So, the news likes to report on what's happening at Ivy League campuses, and that, in a way, creates a vicious circle where students know that they have more of a platform or megaphone because there's interest in what's happening on those campuses. So they're more inclined to do these types of large-scale protests. The media then covers it, and then it kind of escalates from there. Especially Columbia University, which is really right next to all these major news stations, they, for a variety of reasons, they're kind of like in the perfect storm of the center of a kind of a national spotlight. But that being said, I think that there is something going on related to these institutions themselves. I think part of it is the result of students, again, feeling as though They are very passionate about these particular issues. In the last couple of years, there have just been, I think, more acute manifestations of the political differences and political polarization that we're seeing at a national level really starting to play out on these key campuses.
All right. Now, Caroline, you and I communicated, obviously, to set up our interview here, and I shared an example with you here. I mean, if you were coming to Penn State or your group came here, Penn State has had an issue this year where administration has decided to close down some so-called branch campuses around Pennsylvania. And it's been a really hot issue here this year. Some folks have been in favor. Some folks have been vehemently against. And even though the final decision's been made, this is still a hot one around here. If you were coming here to Penn State and that's the issue, big, I mean, what would you do? How would you handle that so that there's some constructive dialogue to go along with, you know, this whole scenario of the problem I just described? What would you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the first thing is really to create space for people to listen to one another. So when we have an issue like that, and really in a lot of issues, people tend to focus on, let's say, like the level of policy, the level of decision, and the impact. And that obviously is very important, especially in a decision like this where there is a clear decision point and consequences. But what people fail to recognize is that there's often what's known as an understory. There are, values, unmet needs, concerns that are driving why people have these differences in opinions on this specific issue. And it's really important to unearth what's hiding under the surface that's driving these strong feelings about this particular issue. So what we would do is we would help create structured spaces where people, different stakeholders, students, faculty, community members, can really voice their concerns rather than debate outcomes. So give people the space to express themselves, share what's on their mind, share what's driving their beliefs, share their concerns, and really make sure that people feel heard. The second step would be, again, around unearthing what are those underlying values. Because people often, without understanding, like, what's the understory, they start to just, you know, get into a debate about, you know, more like logistical pieces of, oh, well, we need this to, solve this kind of economic issue, or, you know, we need this for whatever reason, without taking the time to unearth, like, what are the stories, what are the feelings, what are the emotions that are driving those beliefs? And it's, again, very important, especially in a situation like this where the decision has been made. So actually giving space to hear, like, what are the emotions around this? What are driving the emotions? Helping people make sense of that. That is really critical to surface. And then helping people see, like, what's the path forward? How do you rebuild a sense of trust in this process? How might this inform, you know, future decisions? Could there be a different decision-making process in the future if decisions like this need to be made so that the different stakeholders feel as though their voices are being heard, their voices are being considered? There's a lot of research, again, that, you know, leaders always need to make decisions, and it's impossible to make a decision that is going to satisfy everyone. But decades of research have shown that if people feel as though there's been a fair process around how decisions have been made, they're far more likely to accept the outcome, even if they disagree with it. And so a fair process has three key elements. The first is neutrality, where they feel as though decision makers are unbiased and the process itself is fair and consistent. The second is transparency, so the way that decisions are made are clear, the decision-making criteria are clear and explained rather than hidden. And the third is participation, that stakeholders feel as though they have a say, their voices have been heard, their positions have been considered. And so, again, even if there's a decision that's made that people don't agree with, if you follow these types of practices, it can lead to more buy-in with the ultimate decision. And so I would think about how can you use dialogue to both create rebuilding of community, rebuilding of trust, and also use that to inform future decision-making approaches by the university.
All right. Now, Caroline, let me be honest. That sounds like a lot of work. Could that be the problem here? People don't want to put in the work to do what you just described.
Yeah, I think that is the problem. And the thing that's ironic, though, is that people say, oh, well, this is a lot of work. But I would imagine that there's a lot of work that goes into solving these disputes, dealing with these complaints, and not just work, you know, a lot of aggravation. I imagine that decision makers are getting a lot of complaints, a lot of angry messages. And then the more and more you create this environment where there's a breakdown in trust, it just makes future decision making even more difficult. So yes, there is some upfront work, but it, I think ultimately does save time and also create a better community, better sense of trust among all the decision makers.
Yeah, I think both ends of that are just so important, and I think we drop the ball, like both sides drop the ball in that. I think it is important that decision makers come out and explain their decision. And again, people may disagree with it, and that's the other thing is to understand that it is possible for you to make an argument to actually be heard and to have a decision that you're not happy with be made. Like that, I think too many people think if you're not doing what we want you to do, then you haven't heard me. Well, no, it's possible they heard you, and they just don't think that your decision-making there or your path on any particular topic is the best. But then the other side of it is, again, well, explain how you did come to that. And I think too often we just people think they're not heard if the decision they want isn't made. And too often the decision makers don't just come out, hey, this is why we did it. Again, you might disagree with it. As you said, I am much more comfortable with bosses who make decisions and explain, hey, this is how we came there. Oh, man, I disagree with that. But, all right, well, I can kind of understand where you're coming from, though, with that decision. I just think both sides need to do a better job in those situations. One, explaining, and two, understanding it is possibly heard and not have your wishes met.
Caroline, we got about 45 seconds. What do you think there?
I totally agree. I think that that's absolutely right. And taking the time to explain decisions and to make sure people feel heard goes a long way in getting buy-in.
All right. Once again, folks, seriously, check out their website. There's some really good stuff there.
Yep.
ConstructiveDialogue.org. And Caroline, if you ever come up Penn State way, I'd love to know about it. You folks are doing some really good stuff that I think that's really needed. So we appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.